Senator Betzel, you have some legislation that was passed in the one-time bill, but somehow it got referred to us because the pilot's going to be at Minsku, and it's going to be evaluated by the U, and we felt like we should really know what's going on.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to review the bill. Senate File 1662, as you indicated, there was the one-time money bill did appropriate $200,000 for this project. The money would pass through Department of Employee Relations, but the way that the bill is structured does affect higher education issues, and that's why I think that your budget division would be particularly interested in this. I do have some witnesses who can testify, but basically the Minsku students right now have the opportunity to have what are called e-folio documents. They can create their own website to manage their own careers, student portfolios, their education, everything right in that. This would expand it to allow them to have their health records as part of it. And I think in the long range...
Is it students or employees?
This would be employees.
I said students.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But to allow employees to manage not only their careers, but as well as their medical records. This is a pilot project, and I think down the road the idea would be to allow more and more people, government employees, to have the similar opportunities so that they can have their medications, prescriptions, their MRIs, whatever thing, within a website that they control, and they would be easier to transport it between doctors and sure. I do have
Senator Betzel, I have health partners, and I think I have that. All my records are electronic.
Well, Dr. James Frickton from the University of Minnesota can describe in greater detail mm-hmm. what this would be entailing and how the thing would
Maybe
work.
So. Not everything is. Dr. Frickton.
Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you today. The PHR is a confidential, private, electronic health care record that is personalized to the individual patient. Health Partners does have your records online currently, and you do have access to that. However, if you went to another clinician outside of Health Partners, you will not have that. One of the big problems we have right now is that the fact that our records are scattered throughout the state or wherever we go to our healthcare providers. And when you need those records at a particular clinician's office, they're not available. One thing that this does is basically allow you to have access to your records from any particular provider, physician, dentist, et cetera. But in addition to that, probably as importantly for cost management as well as healthcare, managing your own health, is the ability to have many other online educational programs that are currently not at Health Partners. Disease management programs can be very, very helpful to engage and empower the consumer to manage their own health. And one of the problems we have right now is with the busy practices, it's very difficult to really give the tools to the consumer to manage their asthma or their hypertension and many other illnesses. In addition, managing costs, things like online pharmacies, which Health Partners does have, for instance, but are not available to most employees. And you can save considerable costs with things such as online. So there's a tremendous amount of resources available right now online, but to be able to collect them together into one place is what the purpose of the PHR, personal health record, is. The ability to extend that e-folio system is a tremendous opportunity right now into a health folio, if you want to say, to really not only help empower consumers or give them the tools to manage their health and health care, but also, as importantly, to manage their health care costs. So that's kind of a quick summation about it.
So, Senator Betzel, it's just kind of an interesting approach. I mean, I'm just recalling a little bit the rider language, which is different than this, right. Is that it's going to be Minsku employees, and does it still include participants in the state employee group insurance program?
I believe so.
Or will that will still be included?
Madam Chair, the language of the bill, the rider language was one-time money, was quite limited. The bill, of course, talks about Minsku employees in the state in the employee group insurance program, or if DUER is abolished, then whatever department is responsible for the employee group insurance program. Ultimately, that's the goal, but right now, as a pilot project, it would be relating to the Minsku employees.
MNSCU employees. And it did still have, I don't see this, the University of Minnesota Department of Health Informatics was, is that where you're from, Dr. Frickman?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Why doesn't, why aren't we doing this with University of Minnesota employees?
Well, because we have a unique opportunity right now with the MNSCU system because of the eFolio. eFolio is not being used by the University of Minnesota, unfortunately. They have their own system that they developed at the University of Minnesota. So this is a great opportunity right now to leverage all those costs and experience and technology that's been developed for the eFolio, for MNSCU, and leverage into HealthFolio as a wonderful demonstration project of how powerful an instrument like this could be if you put it into hands of a broad population like the MNSCU employees.
Okay. Senator Bessel, do you know where this issue is going to be conferenced? Is it going to be conferenced in your committee or in my committee?
That I don't know.
Because the one-time money is being divided up, right?
It's the one-time money. It could be either one of them. The state government budget one would be one place to do it because it does have the potentially a broader look at state employees. However, since this is a pilot project with MNSCU,
that would
be more logical within yours. I think we're just going to have to resolve that issue as the conference committees are being appointed and figure out where the best place is. I think that, again, given the fact that it is more MNSCU-oriented right now, I think that this budget division would have probably the interest in watching it, and then the state government one would be kind of watching what happens. But okay. I don't control that part, so.
Any questions from the committee, then we'll take testimony. Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Betzel. At line 1.22, there's reference to the records may provide instead of shall, and one item on the next page, 2.3, is privacy, security, compliance. Would that be something, especially privacy, that you'd want to make absolutely sure there's compliance instead of may?
Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, let me just double check.
We don't have any of this language in the rider.
Right. But, of course, setting.
And this is goals anyway.
These are the goals that would not necessarily be in the rider language. I think that's probably a good point that we do want to make sure. Well, I don't know whether the health records have to include prescription appointment information. If I don't want them, why should I have there? I think there's some certain security issues that you certainly do want, but given the fact that these folios are personalized to the individual, some of these you may want and some may not.
And only the individual has access to them.
Only the individual has access to it. You definitely want to make it sure it's secure because you don't want to have other people getting access to it. But I'm told that right now they are secure because only the student or the employee who allows access to others, has the access to the websites.
Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, and Doctor, you can ponder that. The first three items, I know it would be discretionary, but privacy, I think, is non-negotiable for compliance. The other question I had is, if you have a family plan and you wanted to look at medical records for minors, of course, there's privacy rights minors have on certain treatment. Maybe you could comment on that as well.
Yes.
Frickton.
Thank you, Chairman and Senator Wieger. The privacy issues are very, very important to the consumers. We're currently implementing this system, similar system, in Carlson employees in the town of Wilmer through an e-health grant that we're doing, as well as I have a grant currently with the National Institute of Health, and we're doing something very similar and have several other grants in. Privacy is clearly one of the top issues among all consumers with regard to that. And that's why this system and the systems that we're implementing probably go beyond the state and federal regulations that for both HIPAA and security and privacy. And to some extent, I would say that these personal health records and some of the electronic medical records are more secure than paper versions currently, and so that's actually one of the enhancements or advantages of having this type of system.
Madam Chair, on the issue of the policyholder or employee's access to family members' records, particularly if they're a minor.
Yes, thank you very much. Now, you, as an individual adult, can give permission to, say, for instance, health providers, physicians that you see, to view your records so that they don't have to reproduce any laboratory values. The same permission can come from parents who have children, and so the parents of children under the age will have be able to view their records and set them up and change them and modify them as they go. And so it is, and you can, as an adult, as say as a senior, can also authorize a caregiver to be managing your health care records also. However, you know, you have to go through a process for signing that authorization. But it allows for that type of security and authentication process for both children as well as older adults.
Oh, Madam Chair, I was looking particularly at some of the privacy protections that minors have, STD treatment and other items, and how you negotiate that.
Well,
on access.
I mean, some of those issues we're crossing. I mean, they're very important ethical issues with regard to whether a parent has those issues. And they will, as we develop more technology and regulations with regard to personal health records, which they're currently developing throughout the nation, those are some of the issues we will cross. But of course, you can look at some of the record. You know, you can view some of the record and not others, and those. So you're always going to have that issue that's going to have to be kind of considered as you go. But it's something we have talked about and discussed in many of the roundtables we have at national meetings with regard to electronic records. But it's a very important issue. Thank you for bringing it up.
Senator Betzold, I think that Senator Wieger brings up a good point. So down the road when we're looking at any kind of language that we're going to have in whatever bill this is going to be in, we probably should make sure that privacy, security, et cetera, is a requirement.
Oh, I'm quite aware of those issues, okay. I'm sure.
Then is there any questions from members of the committee?
I believe Dewar had some concerns.
Yes, Lorna Smith from Dewar wanted to comment. She is. Oh, they don't look like Lorna Smith. Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Betzold. I'm not sure if this has been covered or not, but my question is regard to the where the funds are coming from this, the Healthcare Access Fund. I would be, I think that it would be interesting to take a look at what those funds are typically used for or what the intent is there. And I just think we need to kind of clarify if this is an appropriate expenditure for that particular fund or not. But I presume that bill would make a stop in the health finance.
Well, Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair. The issue has been decided. When we passed the one-time bill, $200,000 of one-time money was set aside for this. Mm-hmm. So we're not anticipating pulling $5 million out of the Healthcare Access Fund to do this. I don't know if Senate Counsel has any suggestions as to how to rework this. This bill would certainly have to be reviewed by the full Finance Committee, and if the Health Budget Division would also like to look at it, that's fine, but the language in the appropriation section is not going to work because of the decisions that have already been made in the one-time money bill.
Senator Betzold and Senator Lynch and any other late arrivals, because our policy deadlines are later than our money deadlines, it's just a little awkward with some of these bills. Since this bill has already been put in the one-time bill as a rider, although we're not sure where it's going to go from there, we don't need to take any action today. We're just basically hearing the legislation. Most of the legislation before us is either in another bill or it's in the House. And I felt like it was really important for the committee members to be familiar, since if you're going to be on the conference committee, or it's just good for us to be familiar with what the House is doing or what is in other bills. So our any comments we make would be advisory to Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold. music to my ears regarding the Healthcare Access Fund. But I just
we've had those problems here. I know.
We don't want to lose sight of that.
Okay, from Doer.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. My name is Nathan Morocco, and I'm the manager of the State Employee Group Insurance Program. And thank you for just giving me a moment to talk about.
How do you spell your last name?
It's Morocco, M as in Mary, O-R-A-C-C-O.
Oh, as in the country. All right, thanks.
Okay. Again, thank you for the opportunity just to comment briefly on this legislation. As noted in the legislation, it does ask that Minsky collaborate with Doer on this project. And as such, we haven't really been involved up until this point. So really currently we're just trying to gather more information, and we've been asking a lot of questions about the exact scope and goal of this proposed legislation. As administrators of a health program, we understand the general concept of these e-portfolios or e-health records, but we're not sure if there's anything specific beyond that in this legislation that's trying to be addressed beyond what is already being looked at in the broader community out there in the state of Minnesota. What we are aware of as administrators of a program, we do have currently three health providers that are part of the CEGIT program. And as the doctor mentioned, and I think as you had commented, there are some versions of this out there. As you referenced, Health Partners does have both a sort of passive program as well as where you can develop your own content in a portfolio, as well as pushing information into an e-health record system by where some of your claims data might be in there. So we're aware that there are current programs out there, and we are actually working with our vendors, both for the 07 year and for the 08 year, on these very issues in terms of how can we create broader usage, how can we create more functionality, how can we create the portability, again, as the doctor referenced, so that it's really usable across the broad spectrum of services and being more portable. We do know that there are products out there that can also range in the millions of dollars, not only for the products themselves, but for the technology that goes into actually coordinating all this data and this activity. And so really it covers quite a wide spectrum of costs, from either being potentially free if we're able to utilize our current vendors to potentially being in the millions of dollars. So as such, we feel that what our fiscal note does represent is what we feel would be our due diligence in terms of really trying to create a broader understanding of what the intention is here, what are the goals of this program, what would we really be looking for out of a program like this, and how would it be applicable for our members. So really it's whether or not the needs of the program of this type are being met, are the needs of the CEGIT members being met, and really are we meeting the needs of the broader community, and that's really what our fiscal note is intended to sort of outline.
Mr. Morocco, we haven't seen a fiscal note, and Senator Betzelt has a smaller version of this, a pilot program. Have you seen the rider language? I sent someone to try to look for it. Senator Betzelt, do you have a copy?
I don't have a copy of that with me.
And in the rider language, is Doer still involved, or is it just Minsky and the University of Minnesota?
From what I recall, the rider language, it was not specific to Minsky. We've got it right here. It's a grant to the University of Minnesota Department of Health Informatics to evaluate the use and impact of personal health records on employees of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
Right.
That's what it said.
Yeah. So I think the potential is in the future. I'm glad you're interested in tracking this to involve Doer. But for right now, it looks like it's just between Minsky and the U. Mr. Morocco?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, though, we do administer the programs for Minsky.
Oh.
So I would think that if there's going to be any integration of data, access to the information, the use of employee employment as a means of access to this kind of data, that we would be involved in, and would actually be a significant component to.
Is your fiscal note then related to the rider language or to the original bill?
Madam Chair, really what the fiscal note is really just kind of steps back and really looks at this at the broader perspective on this program and says, again, what are the goals of this program? How do we integrate? What do we currently have out there? How do we integrate it with our current providers? Much in the same way that anytime you contract for services, where you would go out, you would go out with a request for proposal and ask the broader community, what is it? What do you offer out there? What currently exists? How are these products being used? And really use that RFP process to really discover the kind of information that you're looking for in terms of, again, how is it going to meet the needs of our program and how is it going to meet the needs of the broader community around, these sorts of topics of e-health records.
Well, maybe you could get a copy of that fiscal note to my committee, to myself, and to Senator Betzel, since we haven't seen it. And so we'll have that information as we go into conference committee.
Madam Chair, we would be happy to do that.
Okay. Is there anyone else that wants to testify or comment on this bill? Okay, then Senate File 1662 will be laid over, and we'll be dealing with it in a smaller form in the conference committee.
Somewhere. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Senator Chaudhry, I think I saw you come in. Senator Chaudhry, as I said before you came in the room, that since we weren't able to give you a hearing before we had to pass our bill out, that this is an informational hearing, but it's more important now that we know that the House has it in their bill, and so it will be under consideration during the conference committee.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's an important point to make with that, and I think it emphasizes that it's something that we should move forward with. This bill creates an India Center at the University of Minnesota, similar to the China Center that it has. The reason is is because of India's growing influence on the world in a number of different facets. Our past experiences with India are, of course, its contribution to the world as the world's largest democracy, the contribution to agriculture through the Green Revolution, and of course, whether for better or for worse, a lot of the conflict that has gone on, not only between that has gone on within the Indian subcontinent. It wasn't too long ago, in the late 90s, where those conflicts brewed to the point where it was posed real danger to the rest of the world. In terms of nuclear proliferation. Now, in other areas, we see greater relations between the United States and India in terms of diplomacy, but also in terms of other exchanges. In the last 10 years, the United States has started joint military exercises within India, and of course, the entire outsourcing and information technology issues have a great deal to do with the influence that India is having. Many of you know that the India Institute of Technology is the institution, the worldwide institution of choice for information technology. It is once said that people who are not accepted to the India Institute of Technology usually attend Harvard or Stanford University. It is my intent with this, and so that's a modern times. By way of background, the history of India goes back at least 5,000 years that we know of. India, the name India comes from the Indus River. That was flows actually, ironically, it flows through Pakistan now, but before separation, the Indus Valley was the cradle of a great deal of advances in civilization, including to mention at the least the number zero. And then with that is arguably one of the world's oldest religions, Hinduism, and some of the and of course the birthplace of Buddhism was also in India. And through the centuries, there have been so many cultural influences, not only from the West to India, but also India outward. It is, but I think it is the rising influence in modern times that precipitate the need for us to understand as a state and of course as a country and a world, all things Indian. And that is what this bill is meant to do, to study not only all of the facets of India, whether it be economic, social, or cultural, but at the same time understand those of Indian heritage within our own midst, Indian Minnesotans, Indian Americans. And so it's not just with foreign policy in mind that I intend to create this India Center, but also to understand our domestic policy a lot better. A lot of people don't know that the owner of the New York Islanders is an Indian American. We associate Indian Americans with information technology. Sun Microsystems, Hotmail was created by Sabir Bhatia from Silicon Valley. The influences in all different fields, journalism, politics, medicine. With that, Madam Chair, I want to introduce some people who would like to testify on behalf of the bill. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the Senate, for this opportunity to tell more about India. I am the president. My name is Sandhya Gupta, and I am the president of India Association of Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you. So this association is about 35 years old. It was initially started to give a better connection to Indian families who live in Minnesota. It has grown over the years. Now we are more than 30,000 Indians in Minnesota. And because of our varied interests and expertise, there are more than 50 organizations in Minnesota. And now India Association has taken the role of bridging these communities from within and also bridging the Indian community with the local community here. We meet quarterly to see how things are going with us. And just to tell you, the representation that we have, if you go to University of Minnesota, I can guarantee you that in any department, you will probably find 2 to 3 Indians. I was surprised that the person who was testifying before me, the doctor, was not an Indian because, you know, we are just so full in that field. If you look at IT industry, there are so many homegrown right here, Indian Minnesotans who are owners of information technology industry here. Then if you go to, we have a Thai. It's Thai Indus, basically Indus Entrepreneur. So this is an organization that helps Minnesota Indians to start their own business and help them out. In the area of culture, if you see, there are so many Indian organizations that we have very good classical music and dance of our own. So there are probably 10 to 15 different organizations here. There are non-profit as well as in-profit. So, you know, and then there are 25 different Indian languages. And if you look at here, there are...
Are you talking about just in Minnesota?
Just in Minnesota,
wow.
Yeah. So this is all this activity that exists here. And we are, like, loosely bound. But if we made the center, it would provide us all a home where we can show our contribution in a more effective way. And we are very well integrated here. But this will just enhance it and just make us all much more richer than Richard and provide state support for it.
Why locate at the University of Minnesota? Why not just establish a community center that other ethnic groups have done?
That would be good too, but I would look at it as a second step. Because first, it's understanding, making our students more aware of it. Because students are the community of tomorrow. If we can make them understand what India is all about today, our tomorrow would be much better. That is the way I look at it.
Okay, other testimony?
Oh, go ahead.
Sir?
All right. Good afternoon, members of the committee, Madam Chair. My name is Eileen Herr, and I'm the Executive Director for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, a state agency that works with the broader Asian Pacific community in Minnesota on issues that are important to them. I believe that this issue is very important to them. I have a couple of board members who sit on my board who come from the South Asian continent, and they're very excited about the possibility of the Indian Center being created at the University of Minnesota. And to answer you, Senator Pappas, Madam Chair, question about why at the university, I think it's very important that this becomes institutionalized and smart in how the state approaches India, in that this is how we can position the state to take a leadership role in knowledge that is being formed about the economy, the government, and other stuff that's happening in Asia, in India, and how can we best utilize it to help our state be competitive on the global economy. And this really first came out of, I think it's Marilyn Nelson, her idea, because she Marilyn Nelson Carlson. I think I read it in the newspaper. And that was because she was saying that, you know, Minnesotans are very interested in cultural exchange and information knowledge with other European countries, but a growing economy is in India. And how come the state of Minnesota is not positioning itself to take full advantage of that? And so I think what we're here to say is that there is a huge Asian Indian population within Minnesota that we can utilize to help support this Indian center. But in the end, it would actually benefit the state of Minnesota, because how better to utilize the talent that we have and to sort of position ourselves that the best and the brightest of India come and exchange information here, and when they go back home, their goodwill about the state of Minnesota and their experience here in the state of Minnesota would enhance and enrich their businesses, and that tie and connection is so much better. And I see that model really well with the China Center at the University of Minnesota, and that's a very, very good model in terms of positioning sister relationships and also businesses and academic growth and knowledge and exchange between China and Minnesota. And Minnesota can take a leadership role in that. So I'm here to support the bill and to ask you to go ahead and to please set up the Indian Center, because I think it will position Minnesota economically to really take charge in understanding India and how to best utilize our resources for the betterment of our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Welcome. Members of the committee. My name is Bruce Corey. I am a professor of economics at Concordia University and chair the Department of Undergraduate Business. Two recent incidents might help shed some light on why we need the India Center. I just finished an online MBA course where I taught on global economics and ethnic markets. And even before I finished my grading, I got an email from an online student now who was in Bangalore, India, signing a joint venture with a counterpart there, and he said, you know, everything we taught us in the course helped me in my dealing and relating and asking the right questions. So there is that renewed interest in India, and we can see it in the trade statistics. They jumped over 200% in the last 6 years, making Minnesota one of the fastest-growing markets for India. And you can see it in some of these names that we don't even recognize on the horizon. The other example that came up is around the governor's trade mission to India. We in the Indian community and people who are connected to India formed an alliance called the Minnesota-India Alliance to connect people with Indian connections. And you could be amazed in Minnesota what kind of connections there are, not only trade and business and culture, but adopted parents and foreign study students and children of missionaries who actually grew up to college age in India, and they all are here in Minnesotans. And so we formed this Minnesota-India Alliance to do some programming that would lead up to the Governor's Trade Mission and beyond. And one of the areas that we are focusing on is the knowledge sector and bringing people around the knowledge industry together, and that's a meeting we're going to be having next week where we invited MinSCU and the Private College Council and the Science Museum and the Children's Museum to come and talk about possible partnerships. We have, for instance, the best science museum in the world here in the state, and Minnesota and India has some great museums. What kind of collaborations can we build about building the next generation of people around science education or education in general? All analysts are talking about two big forces in the world. In fact, they merged them into one word. They call it Chindia. That is China and India. And these are going to be the two powerhouses of the Asian area. We have a good base in China now, judging from the interest, but we are in an infancy stage when it comes to India in terms of our relationships and networks and establishment. And so we need to build on that. Fortunately, we have some infrastructure in place, like the senator said and Sandhya said, about a very vibrant Indian community and Indian professionals in various sectors. But we also have at the University of Minnesota the Ames Library, which when I came here to Minnesota after I did my PhD at Notre Dame, I used to go from Notre Dame to Chicago, to the University of Chicago, to look at that library when I was doing my research. But I could just take the freeway across and come to the Ames Library and have one of the best libraries that even are better than some of the libraries in India.
Oh, shit.
Now, that has been used by not only all the private colleges, but it could be a very good resource for the community at large to use and access the kind of materials that are out there. And I would like to see that India Center being intricately tied up with the Ames Library of the University of Minnesota. And the other development is this alliance that we are building. The example of that knowledge sector, who's doing the networking? After a full day's work, or between a full day's work, I have to make the calls to call people. If there was some institutional setup that would do these kinds of activities that build a connection, that would be great. So we have a great momentum going with this visible trade mission to India. It's the right time to put that energy behind it and then capitalize on it. And I'm thinking that with the networks that we have here existing, we can really have a very strong and flourishing relationship between our countries. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
I've got some students waiting to speak with me, so I'm going to throw some questions out. I'm not sure I'll be able to listen to all the answers, but I've love the idea of an India Center. I see, for all the reasons you described, how important it would be to Minnesota to have one. I have a question about whether we can constitutionally mandate the University of Minnesota to establish a center, whether something like this has been done before, whether the U is requesting something like this and seeking state appropriations to accomplish that, or whether this is something that's best left to the community's initiative and the private sector or fundraising among nonprofit and philanthropy to develop, or businesses to develop.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I noticed that too. My understanding is that we normally say the Board of Regents is requested to establish or may establish, so that would be fine. That's normal protocol.
Senator Latz, we're not acting on any legislation today because we've already passed our bill. The House language says $250,000 each year is to establish an India Center to improve blah, blah, blah. It also says the center must partner with public and private organizations. I guess that's in this bill, too. And then the rest of the language is somewhat shortened version of the rest of the language here. So the House did $250,000 each year, one-time appropriation. So I did have a question for Senator Chaudhry about, or any of the witnesses, about what conversations you've had with the U, what they feel can be done with just one-time appropriation, and what the plan, long-term plan would be. Would there be private fundraising, or would you have to come back to the legislature for more money?
I've had some conversations with the U, only to the extent that they are interested in pursuing this. And the seed money that we give them would boost that effort. what the formalized plans are for other types of organizations being involved. I'm not sure what those plans are, but I certainly support us having that in the bill.
Partnering with public and private organizations.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I could supplement that.
Yes, sir.
We would like to see it on par with sort of, again, with the China Center. The China Center, the university seeded the money. They have some ongoing money in the allocation for that. But also they do a lot of fundraising from the community. I know that Jenny Shaw, who used to be on my board of Shaw and Nyquist, they are a big sponsor, and they donate lots of money to help the Indian Center. So it does come from the community. It's really community support, and we hope to have that same model with the Indian Center. And we do realize that the community will have to step up, and I do believe that the community will step up to support it in terms of giving money and also using their resources.
Any other questions from members of the committee?
One last comment.
Sir Chaudhry.
India is one of the most diverse countries in the entire world. There are 24 formal languages spoken in India with hundreds of different dialects amongst them. And included amongst those that diversity of groups are a very substantial breadth of minority groups as well. The Muslim population is about one quarter of India. That's 250 million people. That's a Muslim population the size of the United States. And so, and there are other communities like the Sikh community and others that, and there are other minority groups that are kind of based on old historical caste systems. So it is important that we understand just as much the interaction of India as a whole, but it also its many different complexities. And India is one of the few countries in the world that has elected a woman as its prime minister. It's one of the few countries in the world that has ever elected other minority religious groups as their president and speakers of parliament, and so with that comes an important need to again learn about all things India. So whether we're talking about nuclear issues or environmental issues or technology issues, military issues, human rights issues are also an important thing for us to learn about.
Senator Chaudhry, I saw Namesake this weekend, and that was about a Bengali ethnic family, immigrant family. Bengali, is that a particular ethnic group in India? You're talking about many different languages and ethnic groups.
Madam Chair, yes. One of the states in India is Bengal. And in that state, they speak Bengali. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think more people in the Senate have seen this movie than I have. I haven't seen it. My mom came.
Namesake?
Yeah. Oh. I haven't had a chance to see it. My mom came back. She's already seen it twice. She said she cried through the movie the entire time because it so resembles her life.
Oh. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did hear them talk about the China Center, and I'm just wondering, when the China Center at the U was set up, was it something that the university initiated or the legislature, or where did they receive their startup from and startup money? Do you have any idea?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I do not know the answer to that question. I tried to look it up, but I couldn't really get to the bottom of it.
Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling,
because I just worry about the precedent we might be setting, you know, of other ethnic groups that may want to have something very similar, and I don't, you know, obviously the Board of Regents will have an opportunity to review this if there is an appropriation made, but I think that a lot of groups would think it would be advantageous to be at the U, and have that connection to the research and to the educational opportunities. And I don't know that we could offer it to everybody. And so I don't know where we start or stop this process and what precedent we would establish.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I don't consider this a request from an ethnic community. We study. There are Hindi language classes already offered at the U. You can take Hinduism. But we think the case has been made for the formal step to move forward for an academic institution to focus on India because of its influence, impact on the world and Minnesota, similar to that of China. If someone else, if in another country can make the similar case, then I would agree that we should do that. We should do that as well. But at the moment, I think there's the strongest case can be made for a center on India.
Ms. Herr, do you know how many Minnesotans of Chinese background there are in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, I'll try to remember best I can as census 2000 population. But first of all, the Hmong is the largest ethnic population in Minnesota. And next is Asian Indians. And then the Chinese are pretty low beyond that, maybe in the 20,000 range, whereas the Asian Indian are 30 to 35. And since 2000, that number has probably increased. And the Hmong are at, according to the census, was a low number, around 35, 40,000. So all that number, you know, has increased. So I think for sure it makes sense for India because it is the second largest Asian ethnic group in Minnesota. And then also if you added the other countries from Bangladesh and Pakistani that we're talking about South Asia too, that number increases. So I do feel really strongly that with this population in this country, I think we've made a compelling case as to why Minnesota needs to position itself academically, economically to create itself within the University of Minnesota, potentially a powerhouse of working and dealing with India.
Madam Chair, if I could add.
Ms. Gupta?
Yeah. You know, generally at home we try to buy things best value for money. And I look at India the same way. In that the economic rate in China and India is, the way they are growing, it's huge. And it would be in the best interest of us Minnesotans would be to start building that partnership ahead of time so that we don't miss out.
Well, I don't know if the university is prepared to comment. I don't think so. In informal conversations I've had, they've basically said that they're interested but think that this might be a little premature. But I think because the House moved forward, I felt it was important for us to have an understanding of what the proposal is. So we're prepared, as I said earlier, in conference committee. Does anyone else in the audience want to testify? Anybody else on the committee? Okay, thank you very much,
thank
Senator Chaudhary. We'll lay this bill over.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Senator Clark. Hope the PowerPoint's going to
work. Yes, we're hoping so.
It's not that sophisticated. It's not
Senator Clark, Senate File 2189.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Senator Tomassoni, for letting me go before you. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about our bill as it currently exists, and then have Virginia Marceau, who is a constituent of mine, whose son has been impacted, talk, and then at the end talk a little bit about next steps, because Senator Pappas and I have some ideas about where we might be able to go from here. The bill in front of you would require parents, actually required college students, before going into a dorm that they would either have been vaccinated for meningitis or have signed a waiver about not having it. And in many ways this is about kind of every parent's worst nightmare. mean, all of us who are parents live in fear that something's going to happen to one of our kids that maybe we could have done something about, and we haven't been able to. And I know Senator Roebling worked on this issue a few years ago. But I also know that we have to figure out how we do balances within our broader systems. So that we had looked at a variety of types of options, because right now under current law, information is available in a packet to students. But we also know how students are, at least I know how my sons are. If you give them a lot of paper, they're not necessarily going to look at any of it. And so the concern is without more education, without some real effort in this area, that we could be having a problem. So if it's okay, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Marceau. And this is a very, very challenging topic for her to talk about, and I know the committee will be gentle with her.
Well, we appreciate you coming here today, Ms. Marceau.
Thank you. It's coming up on 3 years ago now that my son, Andrew, who was then a 22-year-old senior at the University of Kansas, developed bacterial meningitis. We received a phone call about noon that our perfectly healthy 22-year-old son was critically ill and that we needed to get to Kansas as soon as possible because he might be dead before we got there. We arrived at 6 o'clock that evening. The doctor who saw us indicated to us that Andy could be dead by the following morning, that at best we could hope that he would only lose some fingers or toes. They expected that he would go into renal failure. Another potential complication is a heart attack. He was hospitalized for 4.5 months. He had in excess of a dozen surgeries. He eventually did lose basically all of his fingers. He has his right thumb, and we do have some pictures here, which are difficult to view. He had approximately half of each foot amputated. This is a picture of one of his feet. And the table that he's resting on is in the hydrotherapy room during approximately 2 months of his hospitalization. This is his left hand. During approximately 2 months of his hospitalization, he underwent hydrotherapy every day. He would go to the tank about an hour. Here he is in the tank room. And this is about a week after he's had both of his feet amputated. This is another picture of his hand. When he would go into the tank room, and that was probably one of the worst things that we had to endure, we as his parents were asked to come in on a couple of occasions so that we would understand exactly what he was undergoing. They would scrape down the necrotic flesh until they reached viable tissue. Andrew at one point told us that he often felt as though he wanted to scream because the pain was so intense, despite the fact that he had fentanyl and Versed on board, but that the pain was so intense that he was literally unable to utter a sound. After 4.5 months in the hospital, he continued rehab for about another year. That's the extent of the pictures. We stayed in Kansas for 13 months and came back to Minnesota with him, where he rehabbed for a few more months, and then he went back to Kansas, where he is now working as a sports reporter, and he's living with a college roommate. He developed this illness literally, well, less than overnight. He was in the best health of his life at that time. If it were not for the fact that he was in the best health of his life, he would have lost his life. The doctors told us that if it had hit my husband or me, for instance, if it had hit most of us, we would have been dead. The unfortunate thing about bacterial meningitis is that it does oftentimes hit kids who are in the peak of health, the foremost brightest part of their lives. There are only 3,000 cases of bacterial meningitis that occur in the United States annually, but 30% of those cases occur in high school or young adults, and they have the most virulent consequences. One out of four of those kids will die. 20 to 25% of them will have substantial severe disabilities. Amputations such as my son had, oftentimes much more severe amputations than my son had. I'm a regional meningitis mother. I've met the parents of many other meningitis victims. Most of those kids who are still alive have amputations below the elbow and below the knee. They oftentimes sustain brain damage, blindness, hearing loss. And as I said before, these are oftentimes the best and the brightest kids we've got. It typically hits kids when their immune system for some reason is depressed. My son was 3 weeks from graduating at the top of his journalism class at the University of Kansas. He'd been working 15 to 20 hours a week at a part-time reporting job for a local newspaper, and he'd also been reporting on the student senate election for the Kansan, the college newspaper. So obviously he wasn't sleeping right, probably was burning the candle at both ends. But he was not a kid who was out there partying hard. You know, this happens usually to kids who are, as I said, the best and the brightest kids that we've got. And we can't afford to lose those kids. 83% of the cases are vaccine preventable. There is one strain, which unfortunately is the strain that my son got, that does not respond to the vaccine. However, the course is the same. One of the five women who established the National Meningitis Association, Lynn Bozoff, lost her son, Evan, after a 26-day hospitalization with amputations on all four limbs, such as Andy sustained, and the strain that he died from was vaccine preventable. Evan Bozoff was a junior in college. He was an exceptional young man who had planned to go to medical school and go into medical practice with his brother. His brother's now in medical school. Another victim was Raina DuBose. She was a college freshman basketball player on the Virginia Tech team. She was one of their, they had touted her as being a potential star of the future. She contracted the disease at a tournament over Christmas of her freshman year, lost both of her legs below the knees, both of her arms below the elbows, and had a heart attack as well. I've asked that you all receive some pamphlets, and there's a picture of a family on the front of the pamphlet. Their 14-year-old son, Nick, this young lady's younger brother. Nick was at a sleepover camp in New England when he developed the disease, and Nick has had amputations of both legs below the elbows and both of his hands. Nevertheless, Nick is a sophomore at Eckerd College in Florida. He plays sled hockey and wheelchair rugby. Many, many of these kids go on to do great things with their lives, but what could they have done if they hadn't been faced with these kinds of incredibly challenging circumstances? I would hope that you would respond in the way that the state of Kansas responded to my son's disease and pass the same legislation that they did.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
We met with the ministry yesterday, and they recommended that the Minnesota Immunization Practices Advisory Committee, which is through the Department of Health, take a look at this and look at particularly younger kids. I mean, we've been talking about college, but kids before they get into high school as well, and what their recommendations might be. And if just for the committee to know what how I'd like to proceed, is that Senator Pappas and I send a letter on behalf of the committee asking them to do this. They've said that they would. And that they come back with some recommendations to us after they've also had some young people involved in this by November 1st. So I guess I'd ask that the bill be laid over because, in part, we're trying to figure out what kind of a statutory change, if any, we need versus some other options. And I know how I know Ms. Marceau's family personally. I know how hard this has been on their family. And Andrew really has gone through a lot, but so is his whole family. And he is one person. And if there's some things that we can do that make sense, it would seem like it is behooving of us to look at how we can move forward. So that's what I would request at this time, is that we lay the bill over. It'll still be there for next session. But that we move forward with the request.
And members, we do have a letter from Graham Allen from MSUSA, also expressing his concerns on how this might be difficult to implement at the college level, but supporting the approach of working with the Department of Health, maybe identifying an earlier age.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Senator Roblin.
And I did work on this issue a few years back, which is how the information got in the freshman packets, at least.
That's right.
But yes. We did have that several years back. One of the concerns then was we weren't sure how long the vaccinations were good for. They hadn't really been tested very long, and we didn't know if they only had a couple years' life or if it was a one-time life vaccination. I don't know if that has been defined more recently. We also were concerned because insurances weren't covering the vaccinations, and I think at the time they were about $75 each. And so in all those questions, you know, if we want to or if we expect students to be immunized, we kind of need to know the answers to all of that because it is an expense, and how long does it last for? And so I don't know if the science has moved further ahead with that since we did that maybe 4 years ago.
Could I respond to that? Actually, it has.
Yes, Ms. Marceau.
At the time that Andrew got sick, the vaccine was Manumin, which was good for a 3 to 5 year period of time, and they typically did suggest that it be given to incoming college freshmen. Also, the military has vaccinated for years and years. Since Andrew got sick, the CDC has approved, or the FDA, I guess would be, has approved Menactra, which is a longer acting vaccine. Menactra has at least a 10-year prevention span. As far as the cost, it does continue to be approximately $75 to $80. It is covered by many insurances now because the CDC is recommending the vaccine. However, a number of insurance companies previously had the attitude that it made more sense for them economically to pay out millions of dollars in those few rare instances like Andrew's than it did to fund a $75 injection across the board for so many kids.
Okay. Any other comments from members of the committee? Anybody in the audience? All right, we'll lay this. Senator Wheaton.
Just thank you so much for your testimony. And can you tell us a little bit more about his life as a reporter now in Kansas and what he's covering, that type of thing?
Andy is a sports reporter for the Olathe Daily News, which is a McClatchy company, a subsidiary of the Kansas City Star. There are four high schools in Olathe. They're the highest division high schools. The Kansas City School for the Deaf is also located in Olathe, and Mid-American Nazarene College. So to the extent that he's able to live out his dream, he's doing that. He loves sports. He'll never be able to play sports again, but he was recently able to cover Mid-American Nazarene when they went to the NAIA tournament and took the title, and he was pretty excited.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. While you're clearing out the PowerPoint and Senator Tomasoni is going up there.
Senator Tomasoni on Senate File 1967.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senate File 1967 is requesting an appropriation for community-based energy development, and the appropriation would go to the Minsky system and be used at the colleges that are listed in the bill. The idea here is to actually prepare ourselves for what's going to happen very near future as far as biomass and wind power and whatever other types of energy sources are going to be produced as a result of moving toward the renewable energy standard. And what we kind of would like to do here is to make sure that our community college system is set up in such a way that they're actually producing the type of people that will need to be working in the industry. And essentially, that's what the bill is going to try and do, is to get some partnerships between the colleges and the communities to see that they can actually move toward that standard and develop programs within the communities. And so I've got a couple of guys here that can give you some ideas that are within the system and from different parts of the state, because, as you all know, we're state senators, and so this isn't focused on the Iron Range. It's focused on the entire state. So
I see that, Senator Tomasoni, you brought in Austin.
Yes.
your guests introduce themselves.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gary Sirkvenik, and I'm a consultant to the Mountain Iron Economic Development Authority. And with me is Steve Vieta from the community college down in Austin, who's an electrical instructor, and he'll testify as well as myself. And Madam Chair, members, what the bill basically does is appropriate money over a two-year period to community colleges for the reason Senator Tomasoni articulated, and that is the state of Minnesota has a mandate now that electrical utilities must provide nearly 6,000 megawatts of renewable energy in the next 10 to 15 years. In addition to that, the state legislature has passed a very innovative program called Seabed Community-Based Energy Development, which is designed to drive the benefits from renewable energy projects down to the local level. So individual Minnesotans, political subdivisions of Minnesota government can participate collectively in partnerships by investing in renewable energy projects and deriving benefits from them to benefit the local community and local financial institutions, local governments, local investors, instead of large investors who currently dominate the renewable energy landscape in Minnesota and throughout the country. To that end, the Mountain Iron Economic Development Authority, which is a little EDA in northeastern Minnesota, has been working over the last couple of years to develop a renewable energy industrial park and is now partnering with Minnesota Power to actually build a wind facility in northeastern Minnesota. The Mountain Iron EDA has spent roughly $200,000 to do a wind study, which is targeted four areas in northeastern Minnesota for development, and is negotiating with turbine manufacturers, and has sought out the partnership of the community college to work with us, with faculty and staff, to help us analyze wind, to work on the finances of the project, to work with local landholders and foresters. And we found that partnership to be good. The community colleges need to expand that, I think, for another reason, and that is if we have that many megawatts of production coming online in the next years, we need to have the trained staff to do operations, monitoring, and maintenance. And to that end, the money would be appropriated to build those partnerships with local communities in these three areas of the state of Minnesota and the local Minsky systems, which are well-placed in those three locales. Thank you, Madam Chair.
As an instructor, Madam Chair, at Riverland Community College,
Could you say your name, please?
Oh, Steve Vieter, instructor, Riverland Community College in Albert Lea, Austin. I see such a growth in southern Minnesota in alternate energy, particularly wind power. And as an instructor, I think my biggest concern is we are dealing with training the students that will install and maintain those systems. And in the very near future, from what it looks like, I, as a supporter of this bill, see it as a real opportunity to invest in the resources that can provide the curriculum and the hands-on training.
Chair.
Okay, Senator Roebling.
I'm wondering, how many students do you think would be able to be trained, and what kind of job opportunities currently exist if we get them into the pipeline soon?
Madam Chair, the program that I teach, we have about 80 students, roughly, first and second year. And of that, I would say about a third of those do head into the maintenance in industrial side. And that's where I see the tie-in here is the installation and maintaining of these systems, alternate energy, photovoltaics or wind, is an area that seems to be growing very fast from the installation to the maintenance.
Okay, and I see in the House bill there's $800,000 in one-time money that's been allocated for this project. Any other questions from members of the committee? Senator Roebling.
As I read this, I'm just wondering, are the pilot projects mainly for the training, or is it for some development of these types of community-based energy projects? Is it for grants for that, too, or is it mainly for the training aspect?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Sikvenik.
Senator Roebling. In the case in northeastern Minnesota, it's not only for the training but to work on the development side of it. What is happening in our area, that is, there is a company called WinLogix, which is now a worldwide company, which has a major staff in Grand Rapids right near our site, that does the wind analysis using computer modeling and information gathered over 45 years to analyze what are the most promising wind areas in Minnesota. The Department of Commerce, in fact, has contracted with this company to identify spots throughout the state of Minnesota. And it is training staff to work and faculty and students to work with companies like WinLogix to help developers like the Mountain Area EDA develop a project, because we don't have the expertise ourselves. That's what we're driving for in this pilot project, to find out where are those needs for local developers, local communities, so they can invest intelligently, public money or private sector money, in these projects and not make mistakes. And that's what we see, is we need help in analyzing our data, analyzing the financial models necessary, and some of the legal structures that I think members of the committee are aware of are complicated with these projects.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And I see the money would initially go to the Board of Trustees of MNSCU. And I'm just wondering, I can understand that money going to them for the training component, but I'm wondering if that's the appropriate place, because it sounds like they probably will be doing some granting or grant funding for at least one facility that you have in mind. And I don't know if that's their expertise, or if there would be an energy something under one of the other departments in the state that might be more appropriate for that. I don't know. I'm just concerned about their own expertise in letting grants for that. I can understand the training part completely, but I don't know. Maybe it's more of a direct appropriation. I don't see that here. Maybe it is in the House version.
It's to the colleges. It's to MNSCU. It says $400,000 each year is for community-based energy development, which I actually want you to explain to me what that is, since I had to step out. Pilot projects at Mesabi Range Technical and Community College and Minnesota West Community Technical College in Riverland, and that each campus establishes partnerships for community-based development pilot projects that involve students and faculty. So it's very similar language. Okay, Mr. Sikvenik.
Madam Chair, the answer to community-based energy development, and that is a state of Minnesota program passed by the legislature, I believe, in 2005, and it mandates, it sets as a goal that utilities must buy some renewable energy from community-based energy development projects. And then the statute defines what those projects are. Some of the broad definitions are at least 51% of the total financial benefits from the project must go to seabed eligible participants, which are defined as residents of the state of Minnesota. No single resident can own more than 15% of a project if it's two turbines or larger in size. So the idea is that local Minnesotans come together, build projects together, invest resources locally, derive the benefits back to the local community.
And they're alternative energy projects.
Yes,
so it could be
renewable
wind or biofuels or whatever else qualifies under that definition.
Madam Chair, the original statute, I believe, related only to wind. Mm-hmm. This year there's some modifications in both the House and Senate that the members are considering to broaden that to other categories, including biomass and others. I believe that's accurate.
As long as it doesn't include burning tires.
Not to my knowledge, Madam Chair.
You don't like that?
No. We're not so sure we like burning garbage, but we think maybe there's more potential there. Any other questions anyone else wants to testify from the audience? Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Thomas-Sutton. We'll lay this
Madam
over.
Chair, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Then another project that's in the House bill. And, oh, who's the author? St. Paul College, do you want to just come forward? I'll just stay here. This is in the House bill, $750,000 in the first year for a modular clean room research and training facility at St. Paul College, and it's a one-time. Welcome.
Madam
Introduce
Chair,
yourself for the committee.
Members of the committee, my name is Craig Anderson. I'm vice president of St. Paul College. It's the community and technical college right down the end of the block, in case you don't know. The genesis of this project came as a result of some research that the Biosciences Subcommittee of the House under Representative Tim Mahoney had done, identifying a need for a clean room that could be used by both industry and education for the purposes of training analytical lab technicians, as well as those people that maintain and install these clean room facilities. And as a bit of history or point of context, I spent 22 years in the semiconductor industry with such companies as AMD, Intel, and Honeywell, and I had a lot of experience with clean room environments and what they're all about. One of the things that we were very concerned about, and I had started an initiative about 3 years ago, was putting a clean room in at St. Paul College for the very purposes that Representative Mahoney had come to me recently and asked. We had a clean room identified. Unfortunately, it went to a company down in Chicago, and we had allocated facilities for that clean room, and it's been allocated for a couple of years. Representative Mahoney knew about our interest in this, came to me and asked if we would be interested in housing this, if this were to be funded, and I certainly indicated I would be. One of the needs that a clean room, and those of you who don't know what a clean room is, it's an antiseptically clean environment. It's the particulates, the air particulates are kept down to absolute minimum with very sophisticated HVAC systems, including sophisticated HEPA filters and others. And the reason being is the research that's done in biosciences and in the nanotechnology industry, sometimes the particulate size is bigger than the device or thing that you're trying to analyze. So you have to keep these environments extremely clean. There's our various classes. The instance that we're talking about is a class 1000 clean room. It's a modular clean room. There are class 100s and class 10s, and getting below class 10 gets to be very expensive, and that's typically relegated to the aerospace and the semiconductor industry, where you have to wear full bunny suits and air breathers and everything else. Our goal is to, and this project would be to train qualified lab technicians who have the kinds of skills that they can go out and work with the companies that have expressed a real need for these kinds of technicians. MinNano, it's called, which is a trade association made up of some of the larger players here in the biomedical, biomedical electronics, and other industries such as Medtronic and Honeywell and MTS Systems have indicated there's a real critical need for these people. The reason that we don't have these kinds of people trained and be able to go out into industry is that most people only get experience in these kinds of clean rooms if they're a graduate student or a doctoral student at a major research institution like the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota has a facility called CareFac, which is a characterization facility which can be used by outside agencies, companies, educational institutions, but it's done on a scheduling basis when it is not being used for purposes of research by the University of Minnesota and its various different schools. That is a big problem. Companies who need this kind of facility would love to be able to go to another facility such as this one and rent time and be able to use that to do basic research or do some experimentation. And these are typically the small to medium-sized companies that can't afford these facilities. So that would be another component part of this clean room environment. It would be used by companies on a fee basis, which would then contribute to the cost of operating the clean room. In addition, we would invite other MinSKU institutions who would have a need for this to also utilize that facility and would be located at St. Paul College. It is a modular clean room. It can be assembled in a space that we have already allocated. And we have the people who can install it. Fortunately, we have the Pipefitters Union happens to be the people that install these kinds of clean rooms. It's a very sophisticated thing, and they've actually donated their expertise and time on a free basis to help us install this if we should get this funded at the college.
Mr. Anderson, would this be then the only clean room in the Metro Alliance? Or do they have one at Dakota Tech?
This would be the only clean room of this type in probably the East Metro area. The other available clean rooms that can be used would be at Evans Analytical, which I believe is out in Chanhassen, and then the University of Minnesota facility.
But no other MinSKU institution.
That's correct. The one concern that I have is
they don't have one at Dakota Tech with their nanotechnology.
They actually use CareFac at the University of Minnesota.
Okay.
What concerns me is that the state of Wisconsin is making huge investments in this particular area. If you go about 90 miles east of here at Chippewa Valley Technical College, the state of Wisconsin is investing, will be upwards of $10 million into a clean room and technology environment at Chippewa Valley Technical College in partnership with the University of Wisconsin Eau Claire and University of Wisconsin Stout. And that's a real challenge for us to put that kind of facility in. The initial investment is $3 or $4 million, and it's going to $10 to $11 million over the next few years. They are going to be well ahead of us in technology and training the kinds of people that are needed to support the biosciences and the other nanotechnology industries, which are really a very important part of our state's economy in the future.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Any questions, Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair, was this funded in the House version?
Yep, it's in the House.
For how much?
$750,000 in the first year, one-time money.
And Madam Chair, after that, how much more will they need?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Anderson.
Senator Roebling, the idea of this clean room is that it become a self-sufficient from a funding perspective. We would charge, as does the University of Minnesota, fees for using the various equipment and using the facilities. And our goal would be that in a combination of tuition and also the fees that we would get from industry that would come in to use the clean room would help then support the ongoing expense involved with the routine maintenance and operation of the clean room. So it would not require any additional funding.
I think we saw that one of the university's clean room and their nanotechnology center. Where they rent space to businesses so much per hour to use the machines in the room. What kind of degrees, then, or programs will students pursue? Maybe I missed that in your earlier testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have an existing nanotechnology program. It's an electronics nanotechnology program that's been an approved program through MinSKU. But we also have a biosciences area that we're also have been approved, and really the clean room has many, many uses, across many programs, whether it's be physics, chemistry, the nursing program, and others. One of the other more interesting aspects of this is the need that the medical electronics industry has for doing circular welding on very, very small tubing. I'm talking about tubing of a quarter inch and less in diameter. It's precision stuff. And it has to be done in a clean room environment. And people have to be trained in a clean room environment with high nitrogen and whatever. So that's another area that is going. In fact, the University of South Dakota just put in a facility in Sioux Falls for that very purpose. So it'll be widely used by many of our programs, but also programs from other colleges in the metro area that come to use the facility.
Okay. Any other questions? Anybody from the audience? All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson, for coming and explaining that. We really appreciate it. And finally, we have Senate File 2169, and maybe we could have Ms. Sakanis and Ms. Herman and Mr. Forschler come to the table. And this is something we were working on in our higher ed bill, the private post-secondary regulation. It wasn't quite finished when we did our bill, and this is now, I think, the finished version. Except it does have an amendment, which you have, the A1 amendment, which I'm – has that A1 amendment been adopted in the House or – Do we know? Mr. Misakanis?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Has the A1 amendment, is that in the House bill?
Madam Chair, I do not believe it is in the
okay.
House bill.
Okay. So it would still have to be brought into conference committee.
Did you hear the other ones that you gave me yesterday? It's a deletion. Okay. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Mark Mishkansen with the Office of Higher Education. And you're correct that there is a process in place that's actually been working for the last year and a half. We brought language to the committee on the form of the governor's bill, and I think that is in your current omnibus bill. There is remaining concerns on the part of, I think, the Private College Council, and we have been working with them for the last couple weeks and with the career schools to try and come up with some language that satisfied both those parties as well as our concerns for consumer protection.
And we thought that language was Senate File 2169.
It is very close to that language, Madam Chair. You worked some changes into it, and there's just some minor things that we have found along the way as well that are problematic that I think Mr. Roeder has shared with staff here. I should say that the language that we brought you initially is in the House bill, so there's a number of versions of this floating around now in different vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So my sense is that when you do get to conference committee, you have to work everything out. I let Mr. Forrester talk about the position of the Private College Council. There are things that they brought to the table that are not in this language, the concerns that they may still have. There is one piece that we are continue to have interested in this, a student protection program, especially in light of the recent newspaper articles on student lending, something we'd like to look at. But it was lengthy, and we just didn't have time to, I think, work through it. But we are something we're interested in pursuing in the future.
Maybe we should have a hearing on the student lending issue. Do you think that this is a problem in Minnesota? Do you have any sense of that? I know the Attorney General has done some research.
Madam Chair, we are monitoring it through the financial aid offices and trying to find out some of the issues, as you may know, Capella yesterday, which is a local company, I think fired their or something happened to their
administrative leave or something.
Director. So it took the extent it's close to home.
Yeah.
But we are trying to find out exactly what the practices are across the various schools. So,
Mr. Forschler, do you want to make any comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair, my name is Rich Forschler. I'm a lobbyist for the Private College Council. I want to, first of all, apologize that Dr. Laird couldn't be here today. He's taken a personal interest in this issue and worked very hard on it. I wanted to, on his behalf, on behalf of all the private colleges, thank you and the committee and the Office of Higher Education, everyone else who's worked so hard on this important issue. And as with most of these issues, you know, none of us usually gets everything we want. But we really are prepared to support this, look forward to continue working with you, working with the House and Conference Committee, working with the Office of Higher Education. And we feel that this is a vast improvement in the law. And while there might be some issues, and you mentioned one of them, burgeoning concerns about student lending that would maybe require some further adjustments. We kind of expect that as we head to conference committee, we're going to continue to find little technical cleanup that we need to make also. But we do support this effort. We're ready to move forward. We look forward to working with you and all the other interested parties to make this a good statute. And frankly, we kind of anticipate that over the next couple of years, we'll probably still be coming back in and making some adjustments based on what we find in terms of how this works in the marketplace and what we find in terms of new developments in the marketplace. So thank you very much. And like I said, thanks to everybody else, including the Office of Higher Education, who's worked so hard.
And Ms. Herman?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I would certainly echo what everyone has said today, that we're grateful for the time that you've spent on this, this committee, the office, Private College Council. We're excited to come to you together today to say that we've come to an agreement. As has been said, there probably are things we will continue to work on, but we're excited, you know, to have this agreement to move forward with this legislation. We feel like it meets everyone's needs, and certainly the student first and foremost in the protection piece. So we're excited, and thank you very much for this.
There's two approaches we can take here. We can, you know, this is in the House bill, and we can just negotiate it in conference committee, or we can actually amend, put the A1 amendment on it, and send this as a policy committee directly to the Senate floor, and we could develop a Senate position that way. No, if we send it as a policy committee. Oh, it has fees in it. Oh, then I have to get up in finance. I guess it has to go to finance because it has fees in it. I don't know. What do you think we should do?
Madam Chair, the House has it in.
The House has it in, yeah.
So we could accept
language?
It?
Yeah, it has this language except not with the A1 amendment. Yeah, but we could. I'm sure we can bring that into the conference committee. So rather than take the time to do it in finance or on the floor, maybe do it in conference. Okay, that's.
I think that would be the easiest.
Yeah. No, I like to take bills up on the floor of the Senate.
Madam Chair, I just have a question.
Senator Roebling.
As I was reading this, on page 6 at the top, it says the school provides appropriate and accessible library, laboratory, and other physical facilities to support the educational program offered. And I want to clarify, does that mean that each school has to have its own library and laboratory, or do they only have to have accessible access to it? You know, Metro State, when they started, didn't have their own library. We just talked about a clean room that other colleges could rent space in. So, you know, is that okay? Will that be acceptable for these to get certified and registered if they have accessible facilities, or do they have to have their own?
Mr. Roedler.
Madam Chair, George Roedler, the manager of Institutional Registration and Licensing. Senator Roebling, this would be what's accessible. And currently, for example, over the years, the idea of what constitutes an appropriate library has changed. We don't necessarily require schools to have volume after volume of books as long as the students have access to library online, full text online, and or access to other libraries, either through agreements between schools or agreements between schools and public libraries. So we do make accommodations for those types of things and things like clean rooms that everybody can't afford to have.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that was clarified and that there wasn't an expectation and an overbuilding of facilities when there could be shared facilities.
Okay, any other questions from members of the committee? It's Senator Lantz.
I'm sorry, I missed part of the discussion, but some of this, we've seen some of this before. I wasn't sure how much of this was already included in the omnibus bill that we passed, or if.
Good point.
I'm looking, I know, specifically at the disclosure paragraphs that I had focused attention on. And I actually see that they are
we had this language before us.
Not sure if they're exactly the way that we had left it in the last bill or not. So. Oh.
Mr. Misakonis, maybe that's a good idea. Maybe you want to point out, or Mr. Roedler, what are some of the changes from what was in the Senate bills we passed?
Madam Chair, I could perhaps speak to that one specifically for Senator Latz. If you're looking at page 8, is that the language that you're speaking to?
Mm-hmm. And then on page 16.
I think they're related. One is for licensure and one is for registration.
Right.
I think the way that some initial language had come out was that the requirement was that in all cases that this language had to be prominently displayed. A concern was raised that when you do advertisements, whether they're in a magazine or on a billboard, may not be the appropriate place to display that, but certainly in all official documents like catalogs, application forms, that notice would be there. So it's a slight change making that distinction between advertising and the official documents. Otherwise, the language in the disclosure itself, I think, is the same that came out of the bill, of the discussion that you had earlier.
Madam Chair,
Senator Latz.
I'm not sure that's the case, since dealing with the on page 8, on line 8.27, they make reference to the statutory sections. And my recollection was the statutory sections were going to be referenced in the other category as well on page 16. Unless I'm forgetting something, and of course it's been some time since I've looked at this particular language, but maybe counsel could go back and take a look. I don't want to unduly focus attention just on those paragraphs, except that it caught my attention, and I was wondering if those changes are not made, what else was different from what we passed once before, and ought to pay attention to either now or in conference committee.
Bill has it. This is her bill.
Yeah, sure.
Chair and Senator Latz, as I recall, it's been a couple of weeks, when I reviewed the differences between what is it, 2169, and what we had passed was substantially in pulling in from rules language about criteria for schools, and so it was mostly new things that we were adding. So you look on page of this... If you look on page 2.25, sale of an institution, that was new. These blocks of new material that go on in the next page, that's mostly new. And it was with respect to the registered schools, not the licensed school, that there was more language added. But I think it was pulled from rules. Other than that, I don't recall anything that we had talked about in committee that was a concern to members and address, other than your section, two sections were changed. I mean, everything that we addressed and was a concern to the committee, as I recall, remains the same. Yours was tweaked, as they said, with respect to their concern about billboards, and you don't have to disclose on there.
Well, since I don't recall how much of this is new and how much of it is rule, and how much of it was in current law or in the previous bill, maybe you could just, either one of you, Mr. Misakonis or Mr. Roedler, just kind of walk us through quickly. Maybe indicate where some of the changes in particular are. I assume they're underlined, although some of the underlines could also be rules or moved from one section to another.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senators. The underlined sections in the bill obviously are all new sections in the statute, but many of those were brought over from the rules, and we will probably now have to work with the rules to eliminate those sections of the rules that are now duplicated in the statute. Starting on page 1, on line 1.21, there is a reference to private and, which was added to the policy. And Also on page one, on line 114 and 115, language was added so that it refers to not-for-profit and for-profit, to make it clear that this is applying to all of the degree-granting institutions. Language was added on page 2 at line 2.4, and again, this was done to make sure that it is applying to private for-profit institutions.
Mr. Roller, I guess yes. We are kind of running out of time, so you might just want to do the highlights.
All right.
What are the important things that you changed?
The important changes really are the material that was brought over from the rules, and that is primarily the information that starts on the bottom of page 2.33, information. That next section entirely was pretty much brought over from the rules. The language was tweaked in order to have it make sense and try and make it fit within this statute and use some of the same terminology. Again, going on to the next section, the financial records at the bottom of page 3, there were additions information or materials again brought over from the rules that were tweaked again to fit within the statute. The school closure section on page 4, starting on line 19, there was some of that language in the rules, but this was pretty much a new section. It talks about a voluntary closure by a school and what their obligations are.
Yeah, I do remember us talking about this before.
Right. The additional security section at the bottom of page 4 was a new provision authorizing the office to require a bond when a school has been put on one of the alternative methods by the U.S. Department of Education for student loans. On page 5, starting on line 15, there is an accreditation requirement now for an institution to offer an associate degree or higher in the state of Minnesota. That's entirely new. That's not something that we've ever required before, and it has to be accredited by an agency recognized by the U.S. Department of Education. That was in the original bill. It was not put in later. Again, on page 5, starting at line 524, the school criteria, that language continues on to the next page, and that was pretty much brought over from the rules, again, with some tweaking and changes made to have it fit in.
Madam Chair?
Senator Less.
On the accreditation piece, is there any kind of a transition provision for institutions that are not presently accredited so that they have time to seek accreditation, or while they are seeking it,
but a delayed effect
not having yet received it, that they can continue to operate?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, there is a provision in the statute that allows the office to provide a provisional registration for a year at a time for schools that are not, that would possibly not be currently accredited. And it kind of keeps their feet to the fire that it's a provisional and it's only for a year, and we have to keep renewing it each year while they move towards accreditation.
Is that in statute somewhere?
That is in statute.
So you've got all the authority you need to do it.
Right, to do that. It's near the end of the statute. I would have to look back to see where it is.
I'll trust you. That's
fine. So that the criteria then go on, and as I said, those were from the rules primarily. The limits on the school's name was brought over from the That's on page 7, starting on line 7. That was brought over from the rules as well. The grandfathering of the name on line 714, the dates were changed. The old dates had to do, I believe, with sometime in the 70s or 80s, and we brought it up to current dates. And also on line 7 at line 20, that's the conditional approval section where we can take care of the unaccredited schools so that they can have a chance to get accredited.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lantz.
Mr. Roglin, are there any schools currently that would be grandfathered regarding the use of a name?
Yes.
Mr. Roedler.
Madam Chair, Senator Lantz. There are a number of schools that would not technically qualify to use, say, university in their name because they don't have a graduate program, but they've been using it for years. Because they in earlier times they did qualify for that. There's not a lot of them, but there's a few.
Senator Lantz?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I'm entirely comfortable. I understand you don't want to make an institution go through a whole name change unnecessarily. On the other hand, if the purpose of having requirements for a name is a truth in advertising, if you will, then grandfathering in an inaccurate and misleading name really is not fair to the consumer.
Seems more like we should give them a few years to print new stationery or something.
Yeah, I mean, maybe some transitional opportunity. But
Mr. Roedler.
Madam Chair, Senator Lantz, there are also a number of cosmetology schools that use the word college in their name in the state of Minnesota that are currently registered. They would now be licensed. They do not offer any degrees. They normally would not be able to use that term. And offhand, I don't think there are any of them that use the term university in their name, but there are a number that use college in their name.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Well, you know, I had to read the definition myself to understand the difference, to distinguish what each meant. And I don't think the general public has a firm idea. So I don't know if it's that misleading to them or not, because they don't associate university maybe only with institutions that offer postgraduate degrees. I don't know that the general public has that distinction clear.
It might be a more important issue, though, to use the word college when you don't offer any degrees, when it's a certificate program or something. Ms. Herman, does your association have any concern
Madam Chair,
in this area?
The one institution within our membership would be Duluth Business University, DBU, and they offer an associate degree but do not have anything at the graduate level. But I've had that name for more than 50 years.
Well, there's two options here. If we decide we want to amend this bill, then we should do it as a bill. If we decide that we're just going to bring this issue into conference committee, we can do that as well and have a discussion in conference committee, since obviously our version is different from the House's version, so it's open for discussion. So we just have to kind of keep a list of what the committee's concerned about. Okay. And you might think about an alternative, and you know, maybe we should be specific that only Duluth Business University, or find out who else is out there and if it's a concern. I'm more concerned about the use of college when there's not a degree program.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I can think of Model College Hair Design in St. Cloud, and are there others?
There are, but I can't think of them offhand.
There are a few. Okay. Somebody else coming in here? Oh, okay. I'm sorry to rush you, Mr. Roedler,
okay.
But maybe just point out to us anything that is new.
The
rule, bringing over from the rules, I think, is fine.
Okay. The rest of the statute has been brought over from the rules. Or it was in the original statute.
In the original bill you presented to our committee.
That we presented, exactly.
Okay.
The last the end, the effective dates and transition process at the very end, of course, is new, and that was not, I don't believe that was in the original bill.
Okay. The effective date and transition process,
on
okay.
page 19.
All right. Okay, any other questions from members of the committee? Anybody else in the audience that wants to testify on this energy bill? Little Jeff. Okay, then thank you. We appreciate you working so hard on this issue, and the committee is adjourned.